This is The Thirsty Developer, episode number 63, for Monday, May 25th, 2009. F Sharp with The Nomadic Developer. This week we have an interview with Aaron Erickson, a C-sharp MVP and author of the recently published Nomadic Developer. We talk with Aaron about one of his passions, the F-sharp language. Let's listen to the interview. Hi, this is Larry Clarkin, and I'm recording this podcast on location at TechEd 2009 in Los Angeles, California. I've run into my buddy Aaron. Aaron, can you introduce yourself?
Hi, I am Aaron Erickson. I'm a principal consultant with Magenic, and I'm enjoying myself here at TechEd and in the lovely presence of Mr. Larry Clarkin. So this is great.
Wow. Talk about sucking up to the host there,
You got to do it a little, man.
Yeah. So Aaron, a few weeks ago on the show, we had a conversation about the future of managed languages with Mark Strawmeyer, C-sharp MVP
from Mark.
Indianapolis.
Smart guy.
Yeah, you and Mark have known each other for a few years, right?
At least a couple.
Yeah.
Sure.
So Mark talked a lot about where C-sharp and VB were headed, but we didn't have an opportunity to talk much about F-sharp. And I know that's one of your kind of specialties. It's something that you have a great passion for. So we wanted to get you on the show and tell everybody what F-sharp is, kind of, you know, what's new and different about it, because I know it's got some first-class citizen status.
Sure. And it's in the box, man.
It's in the box.
It's awesome.
Yes. And it's, as you said, it's shipping, right?
Yeah. You don't have to go to Codeplex to download it. You just download Visual Studio 10, and there it will be.
Yeah.
And ready for you to play with it.
We'll talk a little about the history and all that. But before we start,
sure.
I want to talk about this book in front of you. And it's actually called The Nomadic Developer. And you are the Nomadic Developer, right?
Well, I guess you could say that, yes. But yes, I wrote a book. God help the world, man. I actually decided to take my opinions and write them down in paper about how consulting works and how you can avoid moves I make all the time, you know, and career limiting moves, you know. So I've made the mistakes, so you don't have to. And this is the book where you can learn how to avoid those mistakes. And as well, you can learn about boring things like how a consulting company is run. And you have a little section in there called The Seven Deadly Firms, where I name seven firms that you should never work for. It's a really great book. You should check it out.
Let's not mention it by name on this podcast. I don't want people coming after me.
Yeah, we don't want to get you sued. But you know, if you look in the book, that's where they are.
And we'll have a link to the book. But
awesome.
Real quick, Nomadic Developer, that's a reference to the consultant, you know, who comes in, promises you the world, writes a bunch of code, and leaves.
Right,
you know?
That's what consultant stands for, confuse and insult.
I
stole that from somebody. But yes, it's this idea that you can be a consultant and you can go from company to company and build up a great network of people that really hate the code that you left behind.
Wow. We're being kind of negative here, right?
I'm being cynical. But no, the book really does, I think, provide some advice to consultants. I mean, consultants are a big percentage of software developers. A lot of us are independents. Some of us work for a company like Magenic. But
some of us work for the big firms, and
even IBM Global Services. You know, there's a whole bunch of them.
Yeah,
that do that.
So this is kind of the handbook, right?
Right.
If somebody was looking at starting out on their own, there'd be tips for that person too.
There'd be some. We actually have some essays because I'm not an independent, so I don't write about independent consulting a lot. But we do have some essays in the book from some very good ones. You know, some from Ted Neward, who did a long time as an independent. We have an essay from a guy named Bruce Eckel, who actually has a really great essay in the book about independent consulting. Deborah Curata has a great essay about independent consulting. So we've got a good mix. I think it really addresses kind of both audiences there.
Yeah, this sounds like a fun book. And what I like about this style of book, and I often get asked, what are you reading?
Right.
I tend to read the books that aren't necessarily on a specific hot technology,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not knocking the book, because actually a good buddy of mine wrote this title,
sure.
Chad Campbell, like Silverlight 2 in Action,
right?
Doesn't interest me as much because it's
quickly going to be replaced by Civil Light 3 in action. And I hope that Chad writes that book. And it's probably just a, you know, an absolutely fantastic book. But the things that are on the hot new trend kind of stuff, those are the books that I tend to avoid. If I'm going to invest in reading a book, and yours is a few hundred pages, right?
408.
Yeah, okay.
Good size book.
If I'm going to invest that amount of time, I want it to live on for like 10 years.
Right.
You know, or at least five, right? So I tend to read business books or books about software engineering, the things that aren't going to go out of style when the next version, you know, releases. And occasionally I do read a book on a specific technology, but something like the Automatic Developer sounds like it's something that'll be valuable in 10 years as it is today.
That's the evil part of me. I was hoping that maybe, just maybe, I'll probably not make any money from this book at all, but theoretically it should be valid for the next 20 years. And so the royalty, you know, we'll see. But, you know, I think it's a very timely book regardless of whatever economic cycle you're in, and it might even be usable in 2020. We'll see.
Cool. So do you think that potentially the consulting firms, you know, if they bring in like a class of new consultants out of college, would it be something that they could potentially give to the...
That would be awesome. So if you are that person, please contact me. My information will be on the podcast. So
should we call that the end of the shameless plug?
Yeah, that's the end of the shameless plug. I'm getting pretty good at it, huh?
I do look forward to reading the book because it does sound interesting. And I actually spent about half of my career. I counted the other day, and I'm like 17 years into the IT industry, and I spent about half of my career in consulting.
Sure.
So, and I feel myself blessed in the fact that I got to see the industry side of things, I got to see the consulting side of things, and now I work for a company that ships software.
Right.
You know, and all three of those are different things, and you have things to learn about every one of them.
Right.
I will digress that 10 years ago, there was a consulting company that I did business with. I was the customer,
right,
the client. And they asked me to give a speech at their quarterly meeting on how to work better with their consultants. And I talked about the like 10 worst things I'd seen consultants do. Like the guy practicing for his certification test,
right,
you know,
right,
while he's billing, you know, the, right, you know, those kind of things, you know, the solitaire scores that some of them racked up.
And I have a chapter on that.
It was interesting because it was supposed to be a very positive thing, and
right,
I kind of took it in the opposite direction. and the unfortunate thing, and why it was so kind of shocking, was I wasn't talking in generalities about the experience that I've had with past consulting firms.
They were specific things you'd seen, right?
No, they were in the audience.
Oh, wow.
The guy that had practiced for the certification test, he just turned beet red and kind of slunk his head down. And the guy that was the solitaire fan, you know, oh, trust me, the solitaire, you know, it wasn't solitaire, it was Free Cell.
Right.
I mean, you know,
this
game
is how we wasted time at work before the internet, by the way.
Yeah.
We played a lot of solitaire.
Now we just surfed the web.
Minesweeper. But,
yeah.
Right.
Well, the Free Cell game actually kept track of the number of games that you'd played.
Oh, nice.
So you as the customer could go in and, you know, say, let me see the scores, you know? So,
wow.
Yeah. That actually stopped a lot of that behavior for quite a while.
Sure.
So.
Sure. Once they know you're watching. Sure.
Yeah. So let's talk about F sharp though.
Absolutely.
So, and it is F and then the pound symbol, just like C sharp.
F#, F pound, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. It's got an interesting history, right? Because I remember the first time I heard about F sharp, it was almost like a MS Research kind of thing. You know, it was kind of almost like an experimental language.
Well,
tell us about the history about it.
F sharp really descends from OCaml. I mean, there's a whole history of functional languages that have been around for a long time, but nobody really uses them because it's not the model most of us are used to. Most of us are used to programming code where you do one thing and then you do the next thing. We have this kind of sequential way that we think of code. Now,
you know, the procedural, right?
Yeah, procedural and even object-oriented. You write methods, and what does a method do? You have, in half the code I see, 500 statements in one method, because a lot of us write bad code, including myself, but where you're literally declaring time through your method.
Right, and even if it's got an eventing model on top of that,
right,
you know, which makes it a little cleaner,
right,
it's still fundamentally, when I'm calling a subroutine, there's a switch statement in there, or a case statement, whatever you want to call it. There's
right,
an if statement. There's a flow from the top to the bottom, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a functional language is a little different. So why don't you, before you continue on, tell everybody what a functional language is.
Okay, a functional language is a computer language based on lambda calculus, which is kind of an old branch of math. But what you see it in the programming language sense is that you declare literally a series, and you can do types. Let me be fair. F sharp is a functional slash hybrid object oriented language. So you can do both. But traditionally in functional languages, you declare literally a series of functions. You have some implicit typing. Most of the functions are pure functions. If you're doing pure functional programming, what you're doing is you have no side effects. There's no such thing as a variable when you're doing pure functional programming. Nothing can vary. When you have the statement x equals x plus 1, which
always blows people, you know, if you study math, it blows your mind, right?
Right. Because
it's a non sequitur.
Yeah, it will subtract x from each side, right? So if you subtract x from the equation, x equals x plus 1, like you would in an algebra class, you end up with 0 equals 1. Now, I'm no hardware genius by any stretch of the imagination, but if 0 equals 1, I'm not sure how the computer works.
Right.
So, but that's it's literally you're thinking of code mathematically and not thinking of code in terms of sequence of operations all the time. There's ways you do that. When you need to do that, you use monads sometimes to specify ordered behavior. But more or less, it's, you know, you declare things in terms of functions and a number of other things that make something a functional language.
Okay. So back to the history of F-sharp.
Sure. History of F-sharp. My gosh. We're going to start in about, and again, I might have the year wrong, plus or minus a year, but I think it was 2002.
Okay.
Don Syme from Microsoft Research invented F-sharp based on the OCaml language. He wanted a .NET-based functional language, and so that's where it started in Microsoft Research. It's been developed over the series of years as a research project. I think it incubated for 5 years before it really started saying, oh, wait a second, we ought to put this in the actual Visual Studio suite. And I think the movement that direction started. The first post I ever saw was from Soma in 2007 saying that it is likely that F-sharp will be in the box. And then suddenly, when that happened, suddenly everybody, oh, wait a second, what is this functional language stuff? So that's part of it. I think as well, obviously there's a lot of people in Microsoft interested in what do we do with 64 cores on a, you know, CPU.
Right, okay. which is a more uber where we're headed, you know, as
right,
a technology
right.
industry, you know, not just a Microsoft.
Thing. Right, exactly. And so everybody's trying to solve this multi-core problem. Everybody is very interested. Whoever gets there first is going to win, theoretically. F-sharp is a language that because functional languages in general help you get there, because when all your structures are immutable, like they are in functional languages, you do not have to worry about things like syncing and locking and state. You know, state makes multi-threaded programming hard. Every hard
right.
problem in parallel programming has to do with variables that are manipulated from one or more threads and can cause a race condition or a deadlock. And so getting around that kind of thing somehow for certain kind of embarrassingly parallel problems is what F-sharp helps you do.
So. Cool. So it was a research project. And I remember I heard about it for years just every once in a while.
Right.
You'd see a blog post, somebody checking out F-sharp and all that. And you mentioned Soma's, you know, post in 2007.
Right.
Now F-sharp is going to be what we often, you know, we throw the term around too much, the first-class citizen, right?
Right.
It is actually going to be, when you install Visual Studio 2010, it is going to be one of the languages that, when you say file new, mm-hmm. will actually be there. That's kind of cool.
It's a beautiful thing, man. It's also going to confuse a lot of people because it's, you know, we've got, what do you have in the box now? You have C-sharp, which is, you know, VB, you know, C-sharp is just VB with the semicolons, right? I mean, there's bigger differences, but...
Wow.
But we've heard this before. But they're, you know, they're fundamentally the same genre of language, okay?
Right.
J-sharp, which, you know, was in the box for a while, was nobody used it, or maybe a few people did, but was still, it was a, you know, brace and semicolon language. This is really kind of the first thing that's been in the box, as far as I can remember, that is fundamentally a different programming paradigm. It's literally a shift like this probably hasn't occurred since people started playing with objects in any serious sense back in, you know, C++ from C days. Okay, so we're literally it's been about 20 years since anything really this fundamental of a shift. You know, when you went from procedural to object oriented, going object oriented to functional is a similar kind of shift. But it's happening. It has to happen because we have, again, this multi-core problem. And if you look at the different ways to solve it, having functional languages is probably the most likely way that it will be solved, and which is why there's the interest in it.
So there are some apps that have heavy user interaction. Like, I think of the traditional CRUD application.
Right.
Doesn't matter how many cores you've got. You're never going to take advantage of that because you've got that instant wait state in the actual user there. But there are probably a class of business problems that mm-hmm. are very good for F-Sharp. Can you give us a couple of samples of those?
What's awesome is that there's a great affinity between the problems you solve with F-Sharp and the problems that, at least to me, and probably to a lot of the listeners, are actually interesting. I mean, I don't know.
Okay.
How many CRUD apps have you written that take something, put it into a database, or pull it out of a database? We've written that app a few times.
How many interesting ones of those have I written?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Maybe if you're writing Twitter, which I guess that's theoretically, it probably does the same thing. But for the most part, it's yet another app that stores customer data, okay, which is fine.
Customer data, order data.
Order data, yeah. Inventory, whatever. And that's a fine thing to do, but we've solved that problem before. The problem I'm interested in solving is how do we gauge risk over a collection of mortgages and a collateralized debt obligation? How would you do that? Because that's clearly a problem that needs solved, right? I mean, that's why we have a financial crisis, because we didn't do that good enough. Well, you could do something called Monte Carlo analysis, which means you're going to...
And there's a great Wikipedia article on Monte Carlo. We'll put it in the show notes.
We'll put it in the notes. Right. But I can explain what it is. Say you want to run a simulation of what happens when people don't pay their mortgage. And you want to run that simulation 50,000 times to figure out what the typical outcome is if you have a large group of mortgages.
Right.
Okay. Now, there's a lot of math involved. There's a complex risk model, which is made up of lots of math equations that happen to deal with... what is it riskier having a mortgage in this zip code or that zip code and a number of other things that go into that. But you can integrate a complex risk model, which you can't capture necessarily in database code or something like that, run it against a large database and come out with a reasonably good sense of what a risk is for something like that. Now, they probably did this, and the real source of the CDO problem was probably not they didn't have good enough models. They probably lied to the models. But being able to build models more easily and make this something that's solvable by a more larger group of people, I think that there really is a big win there. Once we can make it part of our core programmer tool set that we can do things more complex than simple database interaction, I think that opens up a whole class of new kinds of solutions to the enterprise that we don't normally think of right now because they seem too hard. And this makes it a little bit more accessible to everybody else.
I've also heard BI type analysis, and you could say the Monte Carlo simulation is a type of BI.
It's a very advanced form of BI. I mean, I've made the case, and again, this isn't, there's a lot of people that argue, well, BI is, that's what MDX is for on SQL Server, and it does that perfectly well. And there's user-directed BI, which I think, the Microsoft tool sets for that are perfectly good at, and this doesn't replace. But there's a specialized form of BI that has to do with, really complex analysis that can help a BI effort. And so I think that's another kind of focus area for a language like F-Sharp.
If you were going to give somebody guidance about what applications are good candidates, what would kind of your two or three rules of thumb be?
Okay, well...
Or two or three or 20,
First of all, anything that's embarrassingly parallelizable, again, Monte Carlo analysis or... And that's just one example, but there's numerous ones where there's a large analysis component. So Xbox Live TruSkill, which is how we make it so that geeks like me that aren't very good at Halo can play, when we go onto Xbox Live, we can not be matched with somebody that's, 13 and has, 20 hours a day to play the video game, right? So
there's an analysis that does that gives you a numeric score in the end, right?
Exactly. So something like that where you're working over a lot of data. Embarrassingly parallel, that's a great candidate for something like F-Sharp. I've heard of people doing DSLs in F-Sharp just because of the syntax is a little easier to deal with and because you are a fully object-oriented language. I mean, you can do mutable variables in F-Sharp. It takes a little bit more effort, but as a language goes, it's a nice way to...
And a DSL is?
A domain-specific language.
Okay. Yeah, yes. We throw around a TLA,
We're not talking about, DSL in the internet service provider sense. We're talking about domain-specific language, right? So it's great at that.
Well, go ahead and describe what a DSL is. That's where I actually create another language that, is specific to the business domain that I've got, right? So I've got a mortgage, as part of the actual language itself.
Right. And so that you can create, an environment where you can deal with these kind of more elaborate concepts with the language. And that's, I'm not a DSL expert. I mean, I've been kind of told. I'm not the guy to ask about that. You know, I've been told.
Well, yeah, this isn't a DSL show. Yeah.
But, you know, from what I understand, it's good for those kinds of problems. You know, Ted Neward and some other people can probably give you a better description of
Ted's
why
around. I might try to get him on the show.
Get a hold of him. He would do this show, too. So there's that. But then generally, I also hear services are a good use for this, because certainly in a case where you don't have to be interactive, I mean, the closer you get to writing WinForms apps or writing even certain kinds of WPF apps where you're dealing with an API that's fundamentally imperative and fundamentally about, you know, setting properties on objects and setting things in general,
right?
Those probably aren't good candidates. I can more easily talk about what I wouldn't do in F#, which is, for example...
Well, that was the next question, by the way.
Yeah, I wouldn't be writing my UI layer in F# at all. I probably wouldn't write anything that needs to manipulate complex models in F#. You know, anything that's fundamentally object-oriented, anything that's really about the core nouns of a system and manipulating them, and where all the logic is there, I wouldn't use a functional language for that. I think there's maybe that's where we use domain-driven design or some other concept to deal with those kinds of problem spaces. But for things that are computation and analysis, that's probably the first best place, and there's other ones that other people will talk about.
So if you actually had an application where you had an end-user component written in WPF or WinForms or whatever,
right,
you know, that would front-end this, you would actually write the user interface, the
right,
WinForms piece of it, in VB
C-sharp.
Or C#,
yeah,
whatever the person's familiar with, and just have a library that was the F# component.
So that is the beauty of .NET, that you can mix and match these things.
Well, I was going to say that what you have to do is make sure that that's just in an assembly of itself, right? Because
right.
I don't think in the same assembly.
You can't do it in the same assembly. But certainly you would have a different assembly that has a library that you can... It's really easy to consume F# from C# code in that way. I mean, there's some things that you're going to have to think about how you draw up your API, right? I mean, if you're returning... Because F# has a concept of something called a tuple, which is just kind of taking two things and jamming them together and pairing them up.
A tuple?
Yeah, or a tuple. I probably pronounce it wrong, but, you know, whatever. But you can return something like that. And then when you get that back in C#, you're going to get this strange type that combines two things. And so that's not necessarily a good model. But if you drop a nice API to your F#-based library and then have all your internal stuff use all the F# goodness, that's a perfectly good way to draw up.
Yeah, a lot of times if you're doing that, you know, the longitudinal analysis that you talked about there,
mm-hmm,
a lot of things, the only thing you have to tell the library doing the analysis is go, right?
Right, exactly. And that's pretty much all I find myself doing, frankly, in those kinds of cases. You know, I return a data structure. Yeah, I might return a data structure that is oriented towards being just kind of a general, you know, CLI, you know, general set of types that everybody supports.
Okay.
Right, or a general model that everybody would support.
So you might have some, you know, return results of of that, but the great majority of that's not going to if you're going to be doing 50,000 records worth of analysis, you know, over the course of 6 years, you're not going to feed those into the function call. You're going to have those in a database or something.
Right, right.
And F# has full access to ADO.NET because it is fundamentally
It's a .NET language.
It's a .NET
like
language.
Else, you have every API that you'd ever want from everything else. So if you want to do workflow in F#, yeah, no problem.
Cool. So if somebody was interested in F#, this was a question I started asking earlier.
Sure.
You know, what would you say is a good resource? Where would they start? You know, I'm sure there's a couple of good books. There's probably a couple of good blogs.
Right. If I were going books, I would start with Expert F#, Don Syme. By A Press. That's the kind of definitive F# guide. I think they're going to do some of it's a couple versions old, and so there's a couple things that are different now, but that's just, you know, more things are, most of it's current, and I think that's a great, that's kind of the canonical resource. There's also Foundations of F# by Robert Pinkering. That's a great kind of, I think more, it has a slightly different take on it, but it's also an A Press title, and I think it's designed to be kind of the first one you read.
Okay.
Then you read Expert. There's also a book called F# for Scientists by a guy named John Harrop that I hear good things about. And there's a lot. I know a few people writing F# books right now.
I would expect that because it's part of the, you know, Basic Visual Studio install right now, that it'll become more popular, right?
Yes.
It's because it's there by default, right?
I think there's, especially because there's just a lot of curiosity about it. So there's going to be a lot of people buying books. And I think I've seen a lot of interest from kind of the book publishing world about, you know, we really need to write F# books. So it's certainly, I think there's some momentum growing behind it. And I think that's indicative, I think, of what's coming next year.
How about big blogs or, you know, the F-Sharp community online or something?
Yeah, there's actually something called Planet F-Sharp, which is a feed that aggregates every blog post that happens to mention F-Sharp in it. So I would just go on Live Search or whatever your favorite search engine is and type in Planet F-Sharp, and it will bring up that feed. There's also the MSDN. There's a F-Sharp center on MSDN that has links to a good number of resources. HubFS, for example, that's a forum where I think a lot of the big F-Sharp players, if you will, do a lot of answering of questions. Though it's gotten easier, because it used to be that the F-Sharp, you know, there wasn't much syntax help when you wrote an F-Sharp program prior to about a year ago.
Okay.
So that would be, you'd get a lot of questions just, you know, what does this mean? With the interactive environment, which is now, you can download it and run it in Visual Studio 2008. It's designed to run in the editor now, and you get good IntelliSense and good help just like you would with the other languages. So it's
the niceties are all coming online now.
Yeah, it's if you go there, you'll pretty quickly be able to use it. It's, you know, Hello World probably will take you maybe an hour, maybe less. I mean, it's one line of code.
An hour to do Hello World? Wow. You know,
well, that includes the download time for the
okay.
A couple reboots. I don't know if it takes a reboot.
I was going to say, Hello World's a lot faster in traditional procedural languages.
Well, not to type it, but to, you know, get your head around how do I set this up. You know, just remember the light directive and you'll be fine. So
okay. So I want to end with kind of a more abstract question, because it's when we were talking with Mark Strawmeyer about the future of managed languages.
Sure.
I flash back to the original vision, like, you know, PDC 2000 or whatever, when they first announced .NET. One of the promises was that there was going to be a lot of languages that came out. They mentioned Python early on. Mm-hmm. You know, object-oriented COBOL has been there kind of all along. It's always been, you know, done by a third party. I think
MicroFocus.
MicroFocus, and I think Fujitsu for a while had a COBOL compiler. I'd have to go look that up. But they were talking about Eiffel, you know, which is one of those languages that
Eiffel.net. That's somewhere, isn't it?
Yeah, it's one of those tab-based languages.
Oh yeah.
That Hanselman and I had a conversation about this last year. That it's like, I was like, dude, you're one tab away from death, you know. Because I actually worked on one of those tab-sensitive languages back in college, and literally, you know, one accidental tab and, you know, the whole flow of your program
something
changed.
Something that cares about white space?
Yes, something that cares about white
F-Sharp
space.
F-Sharp is like that.
Does it? Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it's like Python in that regard. Yeah.
Okay.
So be careful with your white space, man.
Oh, okay. That's a good... Why didn't we mention that when we were talking about F-Sharp a few minutes ago?
Because I didn't want to turn
you off
from the language.
Well, yeah, you've heard me. Whoa. They had the promise of all these languages, and that kind of went away for a while,
right?
Especially, you know, J-Sharp got dropped in the 2005 timeframe, but you've seen this flourish of languages, you know, coming up now. Iron Python, Iron Ruby, F-Sharp being, you know, first class. And I just want to get your thoughts on where we headed, you know, from a language perspective. And I'm not talking necessarily, just don't limit your answer to .NET, but, you know, kind of as an industry, because it seems like we invent a new language quite frequently now, you know, like Boo and all these other ones that pop up.
I remember in the 80s, and I'm not that old, but I was reading certainly technical magazines when I was in high school and whatnot. And I certainly remember there were a lot of languages in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, Snowball, some variation of COBOL and about a million others. I mean, and then we kind of went to this contraction where, you know, certainly in the .com boom era, it seemed like everything was VB, Java, C++. I mean, you were everything was a curly braced oriented language or something with...
You left out JavaScript.
But literally everything was around that. You know, you had some niche languages out there, but nobody was using them. And now we've kind of gone to this other extreme where, you know, you can't possibly know, you know, even Hello World in every single language. I don't know that you can have many more. There's kind of four main paradigms of programming. You have object-oriented, you have functional, you have procedural, you have logic, prolog, that kind of thing. And we've got so many choices, even within those buckets. I think there's got to be some, you know, consolidation a little bit. And I think some of that will happen. There will be, I think, one functional language that probably dominates on the Microsoft platform. I think we know where that's going. But even on other platforms, I mean, there's Scala on the Java platform. That'll probably be what gets there. It's probably the most mature. It's going to be interesting. I don't know that this can continue. Otherwise, we're just going to over-specialize ourselves to death, and nobody's going to be able to read anybody else's code. very easily. You know, the polyglot programmer is that to a certain degree, but I don't know that anybody can be good at 20 languages. I just don't know that that's possible.
Yeah, and I've always gone back and forth on this, and I'm kind of at a crux myself right now.
Right.
Is that I grew up a VB programmer.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, my first language was actually COBOL, but I grew up a VB programmer, and I've been doing a lot in C# lately. But I'm working on a little side project that I got going on, you know, right now, and I'm debating. It's like, man, should I go back to VB because I know that so much better?
Right.
Should I use this as an opportunity to sharpen my C# skills, which are kind of, you know, kind of pretty terrible? Someday I'll show you some of the code I write. It's I'm the first.
Hey, man, we've all got it. So
I'm self-critical and I'm intellectually honest, you know. And I part of the reasons I'm working on this little side web project that I'm doing right now is to kind of sharpen those skills because, you know, I've been busy doing my day job for quite a bit and have lost a little bit of that.
Oh, I hear you.
At some point, you know, when I'm done sharpening the saw, you know, on that, you know, I'd like to take the plunge into a functional language. And I actually, there's a group of people that have a book club near me, and it's called the Geek Book Club, and I'll geekbookclub.com, you know, if you're in the Milwaukee area. If you're not, you know, I'm sure that there's things similar, but they tried to learn Haskell a couple years ago, and I quit going to the meetings because it was just such a mind blow.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And should I, am I going to be mind blown?
You probably are. I mean, do you want to take, because Haskell is kind of a pure functional language. I mean, you can't, and so a lot, it's like learning object-oriented programming by starting with Objective-C or something like that.
Okay.
It's really going to give you a different syntax and whatnot. You could do it, but you need an experienced guide. I wouldn't want to throw a bunch of people that have never seen Haskell before into a room trying to learn that.
They did a good job. Background. They did a great job without me. I would have, you know, brought the whole group down.
Somebody has to show you how do you do an X? How do you just solve a general problem and walk you through that? And if you have that, it's a little bit easier. But it is, you know, it is a different paradigm, and learning a different paradigm is a lot different than learning a different language. And so it give yourself time to really understand functional. I mean, I've been playing with functional for a year and a half. I still feel like I barely know it.
Right.
So I can't define a monad in one sentence. I should be able to, but I can't.
I think it would be really good to be able to like have that crutch of, you know, if I'm in F#, if I'm frustrated about, you know, the language, the paradigm shift, that I can always just drop down and create a data set. Like, oh, there's something I know how to do.
So you can do that.
So maybe that would be better than, trying to tackle Haskell.
You might drop into those old habits and you end up with these. Like, you know, I remember my first experience out of college. I was working for PKWare. Now that they're fundamentally a different company, I could talk about this. But my first experience was I had just been trained in object-oriented programming. And I saw the code base for that software. And it was one big class with like 400 methods in it. And so technically it was an object-oriented language, but they were doing procedural programming. And,
right.
And you can do the same thing with functional languages. You can be in a functional language and do fundamentally object-oriented programming if you twist it the right way. So that's why it's not bad to necessarily learn a functional language by starting with something like Haskell and then moving to F#, because at least with Haskell, you can't do it the old way. But it's a bigger upfront investment because you are learning a new paradigm. But I still almost would take a stand and say, try to learn Haskell first and then go to F#.
So if you were talking to somebody, and I'm sure that there's listeners out there who know one language right now, and I think that if you're talking to .NET developers, if you say you know one language, it's generally C#.
Right.
You know, or, you know, to some extent VB if they're a little older.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be better for them to learn a second procedural or object-oriented language than to do functional first? And I'm just asking your advice. And
right,
I'm just,
right.
And I'm just pulling this out.
I don't know that you're learning much. You know, when I switched, I did Java for 4 years, and then I moved to C# after. I kind of went a progression of VB, Java, C#. And the transition from Java to C#, I didn't really learn much at all. Every concept transferred over. I mean, it was useful from a resume standpoint, obviously, but...
And there's some framework differences, but the language itself.
But those happen every version, and you have to be ready to deal with that. The fundamentals of how you think about your problem did not change. You're still writing methods with, you know, you still have almost exactly the same keywords for that matter between Java and C. You know, some differences, but not a lot. Functional, it's a different way of solving problems. It's a different way of thinking about your code, and that you know, it's like the difference between learning, you know, French and Italian versus languages of French and, you know, Japanese. I think, you know, you're learning multiple things at once. I think it's more work, but I still think you should do it if you really want to understand what it is.
So if I could just feed back to you, if you're looking at something that, you know, would stretch your skills from a resume standpoint, from an experience standpoint, maybe learning another, you know, language. You know, if you know VB, learn C-sharp, know C-sharp,
right.
Maybe learn
that.
VB or Java. But if you really want to stretch your programming mind and kind of, you know, kind of really move yourself to the next level,
right,
then a functional language is something that you might want to tackle.
Oh, I think you should absolutely do that. I think you should also learn Clojure or Lisp or, you know, all those. Learn a language in each major paradigm. I think that helps you become a better architect. I mean, this is a show about, you know, at some point, architecture. And being a good application architect kind of requires knowing all the tools that are out there. And different languages solve different kinds of problems. And so being able to do that, I think, is a great skill for anybody.
Well, cool. Do you have a blog to share?
Yes. Nomadic-developer.com. Is
back to the plug on the book.
Yeah, well, you know, it's where I pretty much blog most of the time these days. I also have a Twitter, twitter.com/Aaron, Aaron Erickson, Erickson, just one word, Aaron Erickson. That's probably the best way to read what I'm writing about lately. So.
And people can direct message you if they got any questions about
Absolutely.
This.
Absolutely, and I will respond to them because I like the audience. So
great. Well, thanks for being on The Thirsty Developer.
Thank you so much, Larry.
Thanks for listening to The Thirsty Developer. For more information, visit thirstydeveloper.com. We'll see you next time.